I'm Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a libertarian's view on 12 Supreme Court cases that he says expanded government, eroded personal freedom, and changed the country for the worse. But first, the latest report on high oil prices and airline industry woes. Just when you were getting used to no more in-flight meals, the end of free drinks, and paying for the privilege of checking your bags, now comes this from U.S. Airways. No more movies, at least on its domestic flights. Why? Well, those overhead projection systems weigh a lot and cost millions of dollars a year in fuel. The news follows more grim news yesterday from Northwest Airlines, which became the latest carrier to announce thousands of job cuts, new charges for checked bags, and higher booking fees. As one airline analyst put it, the party of cheap flights to far-flung places is coming to an end. Joining us now is Micheline Maynard, airline industry reporter for the New York Times. And Mickey, no more movies on U.S. Airways. What's next? Remove the seats, I guess.
Well, I guess you could fly planes without passengers, Anthony, but that's sort of beside the point.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that U.S. Airways is getting rid of the movie system is that it weighs about 500 pounds per plane, and the airlines are looking at anything that can make planes lighter. But there's another reason behind this. They were charging $5 for a headset, and I think they were selling fewer and fewer headsets or renting them out. And people have their iPods, people have their laptops, and their little DVD players. So if you want to watch a movie, you'll pick the movie and you'll bring the device.
Sure. Of course, this is all about the price of jet fuel. Give us a sense of what the airlines are up against. We know about $140 plus a barrel for oil. What does that mean for airlines?
Well, at the beginning of the decade, the airlines were spending less than 10% of a ticket price on fuel, and now it's up to about 40% of the ticket price. The price of jet fuel for them is up over 90% compared with a year ago. And this is the kind of thing that you can prepare a little bit for this. For example, Southwest Airlines has what are called hedges. They basically paid for their fuel in advance, but you have to do that with cash. And as the industry has been so hard hit this decade, airlines certainly don't have completely hedged fuel, and they're paying the price that they would pay at the jet fuel pump.
Is the era of cheap flights to a host of destinations really over for good?
Well, it's certainly a sharp contrast to the way things were a couple of years ago when you could get coast to coast for about $199 if you booked way in advance. I think you could still get cheap fares from like Chicago to Detroit or maybe New York to Florida on occasion. But for the typical traveler who's learned to book their tickets maybe a week or so in advance, they're paying quite a bit more this year than they were a year ago, and certainly a lot more than 2 years ago.
I was on a flight this weekend, Boston-Detroit, and then back again on Monday, and I was struck by the fact that on both legs of the flight, the plane was half empty. So I'm wondering if you think the airlines will even survive this. I mean, how real is concern that one or two of the majors could go bankrupt?
There is some concern, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime in the near future, but the real crunch will come after the first of next year, and that's when people in the industry are very concerned that one of the majors may file for bankruptcy protection again.
What else are airlines considering? I mean, if they're already concerned about the weight of bags and movie systems, for instance, is there any serious consideration being given to charging people by their weight?
You know, that comes up all the time. And first of all, I don't know how they would do it. I don't know how you could ask someone to get on a scale or estimate their weight. I mean, nobody tells the truth when they talk about their weight anyway. And then the whole issue is an airplane like a 757 weighs about 101,000 pounds empty. So just the plane weighs 101,000 pounds. When you fill it up with people and cargo and bags and things like that, you're up to about 200,000 pounds. So a passenger who's 15 pounds overweight is not going to be a serious problem for the airline.
Sure. Now, Mickey, I understand you're on your way to London to the world's largest air show. Tell us about that and what you expect the buzz to be there.
It's called the Farnborough International Air Show, and normally the whole focus is on how many orders did Boeing get and how many orders did Airbus get. And that will certainly be an issue at the show, but the bigger issue is fuel prices, which are hanging over everybody. It doesn't matter if you make electronics for airplanes or military equipment. Everybody is trying to look at saving fuel. And I think the side issue is also what's going on with Boeing and Airbus in their battle to get the big tanker contract from the Air Force. So that'll be something that's certainly discussed at Farnborough.
Well, we'll look forward to your reporting on this. Micheline Maynard is airline industry reporter for the New York Times. Thanks, Mickey.
My pleasure.
Now, a discussion about how the U.S. Supreme Court has been expanding the powers of government and eroding your freedoms. At least that's the argument offered by our next guest. Robert Levy is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank in Washington, D.C. He's also co-author of the new book, The Dirty Dozen, How 12 Supreme Court Cases Radically Expanded Government and Eroded Freedom. Levy argues that Americans are less free now than they were 200 years ago, and he says the Supreme Court has a lot to do with that. And Bob Levy joins us now from the studios of WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. And Bob, welcome.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you, and it's a provocative book, and let's get right into it. You point out, and this is a lesson that we all learned in sort of high school civics classes, that the founding fathers wanted the high court to serve as a check on the powers of the legislative and executive branches of government. But too often, it has failed to do that. How so?
It's failed in one of two respects. Either it has failed to overturn laws passed by the legislature, which are quite clearly unconstitutional, or it has failed to vindicate rights that are protected by the Constitution, but which have not been vindicated by the legislature.
Well, you argue that the Supreme Court has been making these errors, making troubling decisions that erode freedom for a really long time. You can go back to 1857 and the Dred Scott decision, for example, ruled that black slaves were property and not U.S. citizens. But you write that the court's real mischief begins later, during the New Deal. What happened then, in your view?
Well, the reason, by the way, that we did not go back earlier, despite the fact that there are some horrific cases back then, is that those cases, for the most part, are no longer good law. Dred Scott, of course, was overturned by the 14th Amendment, and the other infamous case, Plessy v. Ferguson, about separate but equal accommodations, was overturned by a series of cases, beginning with the 1954 decision in Brown v. Board of Education. Mm-hmm. So it was until the New Deal that we got a litany of cases that are now still good law and that are still causing a great deal of mischief. And that's why we took the period from 1934 to date.
Well, let's talk about some of those. The book, The Dirty Dozen, looks at 12 cases that you regard as the worst decisions made by the High Court. We can't talk about all 12 of them, but let's start with Helvering versus Davis in 1937, which basically upheld the constitutionality of the Social Security Act. You argue that programs like Social Security are really unconstitutional.
That's correct. There was a raging battle back at the time of the framing between Mr. Madison, who was acknowledged to be the father of the Constitution, and Alexander Hamilton. And that battle centered on what's called the General Welfare Clause, which gives power to Congress to tax for the purpose of the general welfare and, of course, to spend the money. Mr. Hamilton said, "This power to promote the general welfare is a separate power belonging to Congress over and above the other powers that Congress was entitled to under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution." Mr. Madison said, no, the General Welfare Clause is not an additional power of Congress. It is a further restriction on Congress's exercise of the powers that are listed in Article 1. What the General Welfare Clause means, said Madison, is that Congress may only exercise its enumerated powers in Article 1, and in addition, it must exercise those powers in a way that furthers the general welfare, not the welfare of what Madison called the factions and what we now call the special interests. Hmm. And regrettably, Mr. Madison lost that battle, and the Supreme Court held in Helvering v. Davis that the General Welfare Clause did supplement the powers of Congress, and that opened the floodgates through which the redistributive state was ready to pour, taking money from some people and giving it to others without any meaningful constitutional constraints.
So that, in a sense, allowed for programs like Social Security and the income tax in general as well?
Not the income tax, because the income tax is covered by the 16th Amendment.
I see.
But certainly certainly Social Security. And if you want a modern-day program that's not quite so popular as Social Security, just look at our outrageous program of farm subsidies, taking money from taxpayers who make, on average, less than farmers and transferring that money, for the most part, to large corporate farmers, a sort of welfare for the rich, a reverse income transfer from those who are less affluent to those who are more affluent.
But, you know, it was Roosevelt that talked about, it was the sign of compassionate government that cares for people at the beginning of life and at the end of life. He said it more eloquently than that. How should the government have gone about taking care of its weaker members of society, people at the end of life who I think a lot of people would agree deserve the kind of help that Social Security represents?
Well, that's a perfectly valid point, and I share those sympathies, but I have 2 points in response. The first is that even if the politicians identify an area which deserves the attention of government, and even if the politicians identify a means of fixing the problem that they're sure will work, they're still bound by the dictates of the Constitution. So if you have a program that's unconstitutional, then you have one of two choices. Either change the program so that it conforms to the Constitution, or amend the Constitution so that it authorizes the program. What we can't do, and what I'm afraid has been done since the New Deal, is to act as if the Constitution didn't exist, to treat it as if it was so much tissue paper.
You mentioned that one of the routes is to amend the Constitution. As we know, that's a very, very labor-intensive and difficult process to go through. Because it's so cumbersome and so difficult, is that one of the reasons, in your view, that the Supreme Court has perhaps stepped in more aggressively to many of these issues?
Yes, that is the case. The Constitution, if you don't count the Bill of Rights, which was the first 10 amendments that occurred all in one fell swoop, the Constitution's only been amended 17 times in more than 200 years. That's very, very few amendments. And it is because, as you say, the hurdles to passing a constitutional amendment are difficult. They have to be proposed by 2/3 of both houses and then ratified by 3/4 of the states. That hasn't happened very often. And so the Supreme Court has, but in my view, impermissibly, stepped into the breach. Now, there are other remedies to handle problems such as those that you identify, that is, people who are less affluent and need government help. The federal government need not take care of every problem that exists. There are, after all, state governments, there are local governments, there are private independent charities, and there's the beneficence of family and friends. So while I don't believe that all problems will disappear as a result of those alternative remedies, those problems which then have to be handled by the federal government are very much less than the federal government assumes responsibility for today. And at least we wouldn't be violating the express terms of the Constitution.
Robert Levy's book is The Dirty Dozen, How 12 Supreme Court Cases Radically Expanded Government and Eroded Freedom. When we come back, our conversation with Bob Levy continues. We'll talk about Bush v. Gore, which Levy says the Supreme Court got right. It's Here and Now. And we're back with Robert Levy, author of The Dirty Dozen, How 12 Supreme Court Cases Radically Expanded Government and Eroded Freedom. Levy is a senior fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute. And Bob, many of the cases in the book date back to the New Deal, as you've been describing. But you also write about the 2005 eminent domain case, Kelo versus City of New London. Remind us what this case was about and how it fits into your argument about the erosion of individual property rights.
In Kelo, we had a woman, Suzette Kelo, who had a cherished home in New London, Connecticut, in which she had lived for many years. And along comes a private developer, and he promises the local government that he will create a few more jobs and build a bigger tax base if only Miss Kelo's home is turned over to him so that he can use it for private development. Now, most persons would have thought that Ms. Kelo's home was safe from the government bulldozer. But if they thought that, they now need to think again because the Supreme Court held otherwise. The controversy centered on what's called the public use doctrine. The public use doctrine says that government may take property under eminent domain, but if it does so, it must do so for a public use. Ordinarily, we think of public use as being military bases and hospitals and libraries and roads. But in this case, it wasn't really a public use. It was for the use of a private developer. And the court held that by public use, we don't really mean public use. What we mean is public benefit. And if a private developer comes along and says, it'll create a public benefit if I raise the tax base and generate jobs, then we will permit eminent domain to be used to take Ms. Kelo's house.
But wasn't that also a case about the idea of reducing blight in an urban area, and therefore it accrued to the public good in that sense?
There was indeed the claim that this would reduce blight. And by the way, that's been a claim that's been used by government officials on many occasions. But the evidence suggests otherwise. Ms. Kelo's home and the surrounding area was not blighted and certainly generated a lifestyle that Ms. Kelo and her neighbors found to be very comfortable.
You know, Bob Levy, to read your book, The Dirty Dozen, one gets the idea that the Supreme Court usually gets it wrong, or at least that's your view. But doesn't the court get credit as well for expanding freedoms in many cases? And let me throw an idea out at you. The landmark ruling Brown versus Board of Education ended government-sanctioned racial discrimination. Surely the court gets credit for getting it right there and expanding the freedoms of a huge swath of society.
There's no doubt about it. The court does get it right occasionally.
Only occasionally.
Well, yes, only occasionally. Yeah. I do think there are a couple of good cases. They've come down this term. I think the Second Amendment case, in which I was pleased to serve as co-counsel to Mr. Heller in the District of Columbia gun gang, that case was an incredible case to advance Second Amendment rights. And I also think that the Guantanamo decision was an excellent decision, extending habeas to persons at Guantanamo, some of whom had been held for 6 years. And those persons had not had any opportunity to present their case that they didn't deserve to be there, that the whole thing was nothing but a mistake.
Hmm. Big question about your overall thesis. You say the Supreme Court usually gets it wrong, although there have been a few decisions that are right. Is it really your argument that we would be better off, or let me just ask it this way, is it your argument that we would be better off without the high court?
Quite to the contrary. My argument is that we need a vigorous, engaged Supreme Court that does what it is supposed to do, and that is checks and balances the political branches, the legislative branch and the executive branch. My complaint is that the Supreme Court has been derelict in carrying out that responsibility. It has not been engaged in overturning unconstitutional statutes, and it has not been engaged, at least sufficiently engaged, in vindicating rights that the Constitution protects but that the legislatures have failed to protect.
Finally, let me end this conversation with one of two postscripts you have in your book. One is about Roe v. Wade and another about Bush v. Gore, which essentially ended the 2000 election battle. And let me ask you about that. I was frankly surprised by your analysis, and I'd love you to go through it. You agreed with Bush v. Gore, and I guess I would have thought that as a libertarian, you would have objected to the idea of the Supreme Court reaching into what was essentially a state issue, and that was how to run their election.
Well, we have to separate Bush v. Gore into two components. The first was whether or not the Florida process violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. Seven members of the Supreme Court, including two liberals, agreed that it did. The more controversial question was, what do we do about it? And five members of the court, the conservative four plus Justice Kennedy, who tends to be the swing vote, determined that what we needed to do was to stop the recount that was going on. Now, that is indeed a controversial approach to the problem. But I think what needs to be remembered, and what I remembered as a libertarian, was that this was essentially a battle between branches of government in Florida, the legislative branch and the judicial branch. Mm-hmm. And the United States Supreme Court was called in not to make the decision, but to serve as the umpire to say which of those branches would trump. And in doing so, the United States Supreme Court looked at our federal constitution, in particular Article 2, which gives plenary power over state elections issues and those issues involving the federal government. Plenary power goes to the state legislature, not the state judiciary. And so the Supreme Court served as umpire in that case. Mm. It settled a battle between the branches of the Florida government, and that's why I don't believe that it violated either the notion of separation of powers or the notion of federalism, that is, devolution of authority to the states.
But do you think that a U.S. Supreme Court with a conservative majority in this case would have ruled the same way if it was umpiring a dispute, say, between a conservative Supreme Court in Florida and a liberal legislature? In other words, if the argument had been reversed, essentially.
Well, all I can say is I would hope so. One always hopes that the court is above politics. That's one of the reasons we give federal judges lifetime tenure. And as a benefit of that security, we expect them to rise above partisan politics. So, yes, I would hope that the Supreme Court would have also stood on principle, even if the politics of the matter had cut the other way.
Well, I guess that's the answer to that. We will never know. But it's a fascinating and provocative book. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
That's Robert Levy. He's co-author of the new book, The Dirty Dozen, How 12 Supreme Court Cases Radically Expanded Government and Eroded Freedom. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Rome, 1960. David Marinus' book on the 1960 Rome Olympics. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead today, Here and Now. The world's richest nations pledged this week to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half by the year 2050. It's a modest step, and it's not clear if it will help a country like Bangladesh. Bangladesh is one of the world's poorest and most densely populated countries, a nation of 150 million people, most of them Muslim and very poor, squeezed into an area the size of Iowa. It's where three great rivers from the Himalayas, including the Ganges, flow into the sea, and where, during the summer monsoon, a third to a half of the country is flooded. And most of it is no more than a few feet above sea level. No other country will face greater devastation from global warming. Among the results, millions of environmental refugees. George Black writes about this in his article, The Gathering Storm, for On Earth magazine, published by the Natural Resources Defense Council. And he joins us from the Argot Studios in New York. And George, tell us about Bangladesh. You say even without global warming, it's one of the most troubled countries.
Well, there's an old cliche, you know, that we use a lot, the perfect storm, and Bangladesh, you couldn't find a better example of it. They face really every imaginable problem you could think of, most of them revolving around water. They are fed by rivers from the Himalayas, as you said. Those rivers move over a very flat landscape. Most of Bangladesh is less than 10 feet above sea level, so they're very prone to siltation, flooding, overflowing their banks. The glaciers in the Himalayas that are feeding them are melting. So in the short run, they're going to have more floods. In the long run, they're going to have less water.
You write that the water is the country's existential curse. It has too much water, too little water, and more water of the wrong kind.
Yeah, right. Too much fresh water that floods, too much rain, too many monsoons, too little fresh water because of the sea encroaching through sea level rise and beginning to flood the coastal areas with salt so they can't farm it anymore. So they're also a big part of what we're now becoming aware of as the world's food crisis, a lot of which is to do with rice.
So a flat country, just a few feet above sea level, with global warming as the sea levels rise, more and more of this country prone to flooding.
Yeah, I mean, the estimates are varying a lot. I tried to talk to some of the most conservative climate scientists because it's very easy to get overwhelmed by some of the most extreme predictions. But even they are saying that, you know, upward of 9 million people are going to lose their homes. Maybe 15% of the total land area of the country is going to be permanently lost.
15%. You actually write that that's among the most benign estimates,
yeah.
15%.
There are people who are saying 25 to 30 million. And the troubling thing is that all the estimates of the speed and the extent of sea level rise, every single new scientific report, for example, on the melting of the polar ice caps, is worse than the scientists thought it was going to be.
You did some extensive travel through parts of Bangladesh. I'm wondering if you could tell us what you saw. And I'm thinking of your trip through, am I pronouncing it right, the Sundarbans?
Yeah, the Sundarbans, the coastal forest. It's the biggest mangrove forest in the world by a magnitude of 10, actually. It's huge. It's the home of the Bengal tiger, lots and lots of other rare species. It's also vital in a cyclone-prone country. The mangrove forests are the critical buffer that protects a whole area of Bangladesh. And as the sea level rises, the mangrove cover will be lost. The strange thing about the Sundarbans is they're totally unpopulated. And the moment you get off the boat and back onto dry land, you're overwhelmed with claustrophobia because there is not an inch of Bangladesh, almost literally, that is not under cultivation and population. The roads are just full of bicycles, carts, people, animals, buses, trucks. It's absolutely an overwhelming country.
Now, a traditional refuge for poor Bangladeshis as well as for intellectuals in trouble is neighboring India. India certainly has a huge population of its own. How is the Indian government responding to the prospect of millions of environmental refugees?
The way that India is beginning to respond to this is as a potential national security problem. Bangladesh is a Muslim country. It's traditionally an extremely attractive country from religious perspective. It's extremely tolerant, open, diverse. But India sees, as there have been one or two incidents of local Al-Qaeda cells, there was a spate of bombings about 3 years ago. So India sees it in those terms and, in fact, is building a border fence now that will be longer than the U.S.-Mexico border fence and will completely seal off Bangladesh, 2,500 miles we're talking about.
You point out, and you just mentioned it, this is a country with a rising Islamist movement with an increasing number of madrasas, religious schools. How is this growing Islamist movement dealing with this pending environmental crisis? I mean, is it something that's on their radar screens, and do they respond to it in any particular way?
I mean, obviously, the poor people who are getting the brunt of this, they don't think in those terms,
sure.
At least not yet. They see their fields being flooded with salt, and that's their response. And they tend to see these things, by and large, as an act of God. You know, Osama bin Laden, to take the absolute extreme form of response in the radical Islamist world, has been listing climate change as one of the sins that the West is visiting on Islamic countries. But also mainstream Islam, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is the international body of Islamic states, they've begun also to talk about climate change being an example of the injustice internationally because, to simplify matters, you know, the West, the developed countries create the problem, and the poor countries are on the receiving end.
Well, 9 to 25 million displaced people. You spoke to experts in Bangladesh. Did they believe that anything can be done to prevent this kind of human disaster, this environmental disaster? What can be done?
Well, one thing they talk about is obviously what they've always talked about, which is how you improve the protective infrastructure, you know, this vast network of dikes, and they've actually had a lot of Dutch people advising them for many years. But that's incredibly costly, and they're one of the poorest countries in the world. The other thing they talk about increasingly is that we, in the outside world, have to start thinking in the long-term preventive, you know, long-range planning terms that, above all, is going to mitigate the source of the problem. The source of the problem is carbon emissions and global warming. So they see the long-term solution very much in those terms.
I imagine there's some listeners out there going, oh, God, Bangladesh, do I have to worry about Bangladesh, really? And I know there's an answer to that, but what do you say who are, you know, trying to pay, afford $4.50 a gallon for gas, and now we're trying to tell them to get worried about Bangladesh?
I'd make, you know, a crude analogy, maybe. You're sitting in a house, you see a train coming down a railroad track at the bottom of your garden, and there's a car stranded in the middle of the tracks, and the train has no brakes. And you say, it's going to hit the guy in the car, but it's probably not going to touch me. But the train, in this analogy, is actually loaded with propane tanks, and they're going to explode, and they'll engulf you unless you stop it. When you see humanitarian catastrophes of this sort occurring, and they are going to occur, even if we stop carbon emissions tomorrow, a lot of this is going to happen. And it'll destabilize poor, weak countries, and the security implications of that are enormous, and they will touch us directly.
Well, George, it's a fascinating and alarming story that you tell, and thanks for coming in and sharing it with us.
Thank you so much, Anthony. It's been nice talking to you.
That's George Black. His story, The Gathering Storm, about Bangladesh, is in the current edition of On Earth magazine. You can link to his article from our website at here-now.org. And you're listening to Here and Now. It seems nearly every time we open our email boxes, we're greeted with a new internet hoax. For example, there's that well-known Nigerian hoax email asking for money. Then there was the message containing gruesome photos warning people not to talk on their cell phones while they were charging. That turned out to be a hoax as well. And now a YouTube video shows a group of friends using their cell phones to pop popcorn. That's right, the video shows them aiming their cell phones at a few unpopped kernels that begin to pop when their phones ring.
It's not working. It's going to work. Give it a second.
Well, it turns out cell phones can't actually pop popcorn, but that hasn't diminished the video's popularity. More than 15 million people have tuned in since its release in late May. And it turns out the video is part of an internet viral marketing campaign created by a small Bluetooth headset company based in Pittsburgh called Cardo Systems. Abraham Glezerman is the CEO of Cardo Systems, and he joins us now by cell phone from Israel. And welcome, Mr. Glezerman.
Hi there.
So I understand your company makes Bluetooth headsets, which are not featured in any way that we could see in the videos. Where did this idea come from?
Well, we are a small company, and we face formidable competition. And we did have to find a way to reach our customers, so we decided that appropriate way for us to do so would be the internet, viral marketing, stealth marketing, and such.
So stealth marketing, viral marketing. So is the message here, are you suggesting cell phones can cook your brain, so use a Bluetooth headset instead?
Absolutely not.
It is
ridiculous even to think about that. It is a funny, witty way to create something absurd so that people will be entertained and some of them may be trying it at home. But it was really an attempt to reach people in a non-conventional way, but by no means did we intend to create fear or concern. And at the end of the day, we, of course, disclosed that this is only a joke.
Hmm. Well, there has been some negative reaction, though. A lot of people emailing this around saying things like, this is why you should never use a cell phone. And then there are a host of people who have created their own YouTube videos attempting but failing to pop popcorn using cell phones. This, in a sense, is a successful outcome to your viral marketing campaign, even if it's dealing with misinformation.
Cardo Systems did not mean to disseminate misinformation. It was more a teaser. Mm-hmm. It was more something that people smiled at. It was the way we approached this whole issue that made it so popular. And we have got, I mean, literally, tens of thousands of emails, and as you know, on the internet, you will find many more blogs who speak about and discuss it. The vast majority simply finds it witty and entertaining and a very smart way to market at the end of the day.
Well, at first, there was no clear connection to Cardo Systems on this video. As you mentioned, now you admit that it's yours and that's clear on the video. But were you planning on fessing up from the beginning?
Of course. We had everything laid out. I mean, one of the things that you need to do if you conduct viral marketing is to plan everything at a time. And so we planned to disclose them in a particular sequence. And as we were monitoring the internet, seeing the amount, the volume of viewers and the responses, we gradually released them and said, once we reach 10 million, that's when we were going to disclose that we are behind it and let the world know that this is a marketing strategy.
Well, Abraham, let me just ask one last question. How did you make that popcorn pop in the video? We know it wasn't the cell phones that did it. How'd you do it?
we just disclosed that there was basically a combination between the kitchen stove and digital editing. That is, we let them pop on a frying pan and took that picture because it's on black. You can very simply take that out from the images and superimpose it later on the table so it looked as if it was actually happening on that table. So it's a combination really of low-tech and high-tech, if you will.
That's Abraham Glezerman. He's the CEO of Cardo Systems, the Bluetooth company responsible for the new internet video showing cell phones causing popcorn kernels to pop. Abraham Glezerman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Anthony.
Coming up, a new book about the traditionally fraught relationships between mothers and daughters. Stay with us here and now. Okay, a conversation now about the often fraught relationship between mothers and daughters. The fact that I'm neither a mother or a daughter, and probably never will be, provides me with an important degree of journalistic detachment to take on this issue, so here we go. Let's say you're a daughter, and your mother arrives in town for a visit. Everything is going fine until she rearranges your furniture, criticizes your new hairstyle, tells you that you work too much, and wonders aloud why her grandkids are never around. When, you wonder, will she leave? According to Julie Halpert and Deborah Carr, this is all part of an age-old mother-daughter struggle. They are co-authors of Making Up with Mom, Why Mothers and Daughters Disagree About Kids, Careers, and Casseroles, and What to Do About It. Julie Halpert is a Michigan-based journalist, and Deborah Carr is a professor of sociology at Rutgers University, and they both join us now from Washington, D.C. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Thanks for coming in. And Julie, let me start with you. In doing this book, you spoke to about 100 different mothers and daughters and heard stories about the kind of conflict that we outlined at the top of this segment. Why is this mother-daughter conflict so common?
Well, it's common because mothers and daughters have an incredibly tight bond. And I think that mothers often see themselves in their daughters, and they often want them to live out their own dreams. At the same time, daughters often feel that they want to be their own independent self. So there's that constant strife. And at the same time, mothers and daughters want to be loved and respected by each other.
And Deborah Carr, why are the conflicts between women different today than, say, they were a generation or two ago?
Well, as you mentioned, mother-daughter conflicts are age-old, but we're living at a really distinct point in history where women in their 20s, 30s, and 40s have vastly more opportunities for careers, for childcare, to acquire a child via a sperm bank, to cohabit with a boyfriend rather than get married. So young women today have so many choices that their mothers just do not understand. And it's that lack of understanding and the lack of the mother's ability to relate to what her daughter is going through right now that adds fuel to the fire of these conflicts that have been around for the millennia.
And so give us some examples. What are the main areas of conflict between mothers and daughters?
Well, we focused on three central areas, and the first has to do with courtship, cohabitation, and marriage. If you're the daughter, your mother may not like who you've decided to choose as your mate. We have a lot of conflicts around parenting issues. That was a huge area of source of strife. Women today are parenting in a very different way. First of all, of course, they may choose to work and have children simultaneously, which is a life that many of their mothers can't relate to. They often go to the book and go to resources for parenting advice instead of turning to their mothers, which is often very difficult for their mothers to understand. Their kids are involved in many, many extracurricular activities, even things like personal time. Mothers often worry that their daughters are just taking on too much and not spending enough time taking care of themselves or their husbands. So those are the sort of fundamentally core issues that we focus on.
And how do they play out? I mean, is this just a simple case of a mother needing to understand that times have changed, or does the daughter also need to understand that her mother is a different kind of person from a different time?
Absolutely. I think the compromise has to come from both mothers and daughters. And the mothers do need to recognize that even though they want what's best for their daughters, what mom thinks is best might not be what's best for the daughter at that point in time. But on the flip side, the daughters need to understand that their moms weren't just cookie-baking, stay-at-home moms, that this older generation of women had career aspirations, they had interests, and they had lives before they became mothers themselves.
In fact, you write in your book that to improve the relationship, it's important to move from a child-parent relationship to a peer-to-peer relationship. That sounds like that's what you're talking about there, Deborah, right?
Absolutely. And I think an important theme is that just as daughters grow and mature as they get older, the mothers do as well. If you think about what the moms were going through when they were in their 20s and 30s, they were stressed out, they were raising a bunch of kids. But a lot of these women expanded their horizons politically, their gender role attitudes became more liberal, they became more open about sexual issues. So in many ways, the daughters sometimes think their mom is going to be really close-minded and judgmental. But in truth, as women get in their 50s and 60s and 70s, they sometimes become more open-minded and more forgiving.
One of the things that you suggest in your book is that it's important to learn something about what your mother was like before she was your mother.
that gets to the issue that Debbie was talking about and that you'd mentioned previously about moving towards more of a peer relationship. Mm. So we're talking about sitting down with your mother and asking her questions about who she was before she was a mom. So what was her child like? How did she spend her spare time? Who was her first love? What thoughts went through her mind when she found out she was pregnant with you? Did she ever want a career? If so, what was that career like? And by asking those kind of questions, number one, you'll probably find out a lot of interesting new information you didn't know before. But you'll also begin to view her as more of an equal and also have more empathy for her and her choices.
Now, one of the things that really highlighted the new relationships between mothers and daughters is a section of your book entitled Tips for Emailing Mom. Why special tips for email, Julie?
Because email is a totally new form of communication, and often it doesn't convey emotions. Mm. And so if you're just emailing someone, the message may come across in a totally different way than if you were speaking with someone face-to-face or even on the telephone. So we give specific suggestions for phrasing messages in a certain way in a written form that won't come across as offensive and, you know, putting smiley faces in the message and that sort of thing.
I see.
And also, email gives you a chance to think. Each and every one of us has said something really nasty to our mothers and daughters at one point because we couldn't hold our tongue. And the point of email is that it gives you a chance to sit and process and type and even send the message to yourself first so you don't jump off the handle.
And then it also offers the person who's getting the message to think before they respond. And this whole idea of think before you speak is another one of our big messages, that sometimes we say things in anger that we really regret and we can't take back. So if you just take a couple minutes to think about how your message is being conveyed, it can really go a long way to improving that communication.
Julie, I gather you were inspired to write this book because of your own relationship with your mother. What kind of issues did you have to sort out? And did the writing of this book help you do that?
Well, my mother is like many other mothers in that she wants the best for me, but she also feels like she has a lot of wisdom to impart on me. So once I had children, it would be very typical for her to come in the house and look around and tell her about the wide pleated shades that she thought I should have in my windows instead of the dilapidated ones. And that she used to come with ponytail holders in her hands for my daughter's hair because she thought her hair was a mess. And she was just constantly judging different things about the way I ran my life. She felt I was far overscheduling my kids and my life was too chaotic. And so it made me really think, is my mother like a lot of other people? And I found that this is really a generational issue. And I also realized that she really does mean the best for me. And she does want to be helpful. And this book has really, I think it's gone a long way towards improving our relationship. I was often prone to be very curt or defensive when she would talk to me and slam the phone down. And now I often will phrase my words with more messages with more empathy. Like, I understand you want the best for me, but when you come in and tell me that I should start cleaning up the house, you know, that really makes me feel badly. And I find that she often responds in a very good way. We have these protective table pads we put on our dining room table because she insists they're always on there. And the other day she said, "Do you have those on the table?" And I said, "You know, Mom, that's material for another book." And we sort of were able to sort of laugh it off. So I think our relationship has definitely been very much improved by this book. Both our communication with each other has been helpful. And I've also tried to get to know her more as an equal and treat her more as an equal. And she has with me. So it has been very helpful.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in and talking about this important subject. Julie Halpert, Deborah Carr, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Julie Halpert. She's a freelance journalist based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Deborah Carr, a professor of sociology at Rutgers University in New Jersey. They're co-authors of Making Up With Mom, Why Mothers and Daughters Disagree About Kids, Careers, and Casseroles, and What to Do About It.